So this evening, brethren and sisters, we're very pleased to welcome Brother Martin Southgate from Lee, who is going to give us an address on strangers and pilgrims on earth. And Brother Martin has asked us to introduce his address with the reading of Hebrews chapter 11. So I will now read that chapter to you. So we invite Brother Martin Southgate to speak to us on this subject, strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Martin.
Good evening, brethren and sisters. I was allocated this subject at Lee last autumn as part of a chapter-by-chapter study of Hebrews, and I was given chapter 11, which I was quite pleased about. We know Hebrews 11 well. It's the chapter on faith and suffering. There are 16 people mentioned by name in this chapter, and others are there by inference and in passing. So that's 16 people over 4,000 years. On average, that's one of these people every 250 years. Such is their outstanding faith. The chapter is often called the chapter of faith. I call it the chapter of faith and suffering, because these people suffered because of their faith. And they had to suffer because faith is tested in times of suffering. And faith needs to endure through testing and through suffering. And what we know today as Hebrews 11 really starts back in chapter 10, where the writer of this letter refers to confidence in God and his promises and the reward that he offers. And it's that confidence in the reward that allowed these people and allows us to endure hardship as we look forward to better things. And you may have noticed how often that word better appears in this letter to the Hebrews. It's repeated time and time again. Just have a look at Hebrews 10, verses 32 to 36. This is really where the argument in chapter 11 starts. And I'm going to read it from the New English Bible. The writer says, you met the challenge of great sufferings and held fast. Chapter 10, this is verse 32. You met the challenge of great sufferings and held firm. Some of you were abused and tormented to make a public show, while others stood loyally by those who were so treated. You shared the sufferings of the prisoners, and you cheerfully accepted the seizure of your possessions, knowing that you possessed something better and more lasting. And so he says, do not then throw away your confidence. This is the basis of the argument. Do not then throw away your confidence, for it carries a great reward. You need endurance if you are to do God's will and win what he has promised. So it's confidence in a great reward which allows us to endure. And chapter 10 also speaks about the dangers of drawing back or shrinking back. The writer says that displeases God. It gives him no pleasure. And in fact, drawing back will lead to perdition or destruction. But the people mentioned in chapter 11, he says, are not among those who shrink back and are lost. And Hebrews chapter 11 not only begins in chapter 10, but it goes on into chapter 12. In the opening of chapter 12, the people in chapter 11 are described as a great cloud of witnesses to faith. And the writer encourages us to reflect upon their example and not just to reflect upon it, but to apply it to ourselves. He's saying that it's possible for us to follow even such strong people as them to the kingdom, but only if we replicate their concentration and their determination and their dedication. And he uses the analogy of ourselves as runners in a serious race. And he said we should be aware as we run of all those past heroes of faith as spectators, effectively watching us and urging us on in our own spiritual race. As the Living Bible puts it, since we have such a huge crowd of people of faith watching us from the grandstands, let us strip off anything that slows us down or holds us back, and especially those sins that wrap themselves so tightly around our feet and trip us up. And let us run with patience, endurance, the particular race that God has set before us. And our particular race will vary from person to person as God chooses. The opening part of chapter 11 itself is very familiar. J.B. Phillips renders it, "Faith means that we have full confidence in the things we hope for. It means being certain of things we cannot see." Faith, of course, is a word we use quite frequently, and its basic meaning is conviction. Faith means we have been persuaded by an argument based on some evidence that something is true, even though it cannot be proved beyond all possible doubt. In Acts 17, the word normally translated as faith is rendered as assurance in the Authorized Version. And the context is our assurance that Jesus rose from the dead. We cannot prove the resurrection, but on the basis of the evidence that is available, we believe it happened. Faith is the element we need to convince us of the absolute truth of that event. As the writer to the Hebrews puts it, faith makes us certain of realities we do not see. So faith allows us to accept things on the basis of extreme probability. Faith allows us to show trust in God, and that is essential, for as Hebrews 11:6 says, you can never please God without faith, without depending on him. And it's obvious, isn't it, that faith is concerned with the past as well as the future, because it's only through faith that we believe that Jesus came 2,000 years ago, just as firmly as we believe he will come again in the future. Hebrews 11 contains the names of those 16 people from the past. And it's our faith that tells us they were real people. Because if they were fictional, Hebrews 11 isn't really much use to us, is it? Faith starts small and should grow, but it can fade and it can even die. Sometimes, though, faith just weakens temporarily under pressure. The phrase little faith appears 5 times in the gospel records, and each time it's used by Jesus, and each time it's a translation of a particular Greek word. And Vine, in his complete expository dictionary, notes that in each case the phrase is used as a tender rebuke for anxiety rather than as a criticism. One example is when Peter walked on the Sea of Galilee, as described in Matthew chapter 14. That was a huge test of Peter's faith. walking on the sea. It was a test for which he volunteered. So there is no doubting the strength of his faith initially. He actually did walk on the water. But the record says the wind was boisterous. That's powerful, mighty, violent. And it affected Peter's faith. And beginning to sink, Matthew says, he cried, saying, "Lord, save me." And Jesus was there to do just that. He wasn't there to criticize Peter, but to reassure him and rescue him. Matthew says, immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said unto him, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" And together, probably hand in hand, they climbed into the boat and into safety. There are probably many times when Jesus has to say to us, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" It's not because we have lost our faith, but sometimes we just lose some of that confidence. But faith affects how God reacts to us and how Jesus reacts to us. Nearly all Jesus' miracles were dependent on faith. For example, before he healed the two blind men, it's in Matthew chapter 9, he said, "Do you believe that I am able to do this? Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" And when they assured him that they did, he touched their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, let it be to you." And so, to a certain extent, their cure was in their own hands. And it's just as true that our salvation will depend to some extent on us and the strength of our faith. We should never forget that a strong faith strengthens and encourages others around us. Paul recorded how he was hugely comforted and strengthened by the faith of the Thessalonian brethren and sisters. He wrote to them, "Timothy has come to us from you and brought us good news of your faith and love. Therefore, brethren, in all our affliction and distress, we were comforted." The news of their faith was a comfort to Paul. It was a powerful motivator for him. It gave him courage. It helped him to endure in his trials. And it helped him to overcome those trials and difficulties which he was experiencing at the time. And the examples of faith in Hebrews chapter 11 should do the same for us. Faith is all to do with looking for something better. And in some places in the New Testament, faith and hope are almost interchangeable. Faith has been defined as having a favourable and confident expectation or a happy anticipation of good. And it is true that despite the trials we might have now, we have a confidence, an inner confidence, that everything is going to work out well for us in the end by God's grace. The strangers and pilgrims of Hebrews chapter 11 were all looking for something better. They all had that confident expectation that the future would be better than the present, because they all believed in that personal reward and in that prize at the end of the race. So, as I've said, 16 named individuals in Hebrews 11. What 16 would you have chosen? What 16 would I have chosen? Would I have chosen Samson? Probably not, but he's there by name, one of the 16. Would I have chosen Daniel? Probably, but he's not there by name, though he is there by inference. And I think that shows just how faulty my assessment of people can be. It shows perhaps how God's view is different from mine. God looks on the heart, on motivation, on what is intended, rather than what actually happens. The outward view that we so often look at is worthless to God, and mostly it's useless to us today. I want to look at just four of the 16 people mentioned in chapter 11. And obviously, I had to start with Samson. It's very easy to typecast people wrongly. Easy to typecast Samson as a womanizer, someone who went out and married an alien woman. And that typecasting can cloud our judgment to the reality. It can easily lead us to see Samson as all bad and overlook his many strong points. And it's logical, isn't it, that he would not be one of 16 people in Hebrews chapter 11 if the good in his life didn't vastly outweigh the failures. Samson judged Israel for 20 years, and like so many other Bible characters, we know nothing about most of his life. So don't let's misjudge him, but let's look carefully at what we do know about him. Think about the many good things that we know about Samson. He was the child of promise from God to a barren woman. He was given a divine mission from his birth to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. We're specifically told that he was blessed by God from his birth. We're told that he was guided by the Spirit of God. We know that he faithfully kept to his Nazarite vow until the end of his life, when he lost it by deception. When he was dying of thirst after a battle, his first reaction was to seek help from God. He achieved great success in his God-given mission to save God's people, and he acknowledged that the victories over the Philistines were God-given. He acknowledged that his great physical strength was a gift from God for a purpose. And I think it's arguable that taking a Philistine wife was all part of his plan to carry out God's plan to defeat the Philistines. Hebrews 11 commends him for his great faith, along with others. And Samson is not the only one in Hebrews chapter 11 with serious failings. David, for example, is also there. Remember that the time of the judges was a terrible time for serving God. Every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. And for Samson to trust God so implicitly in that environment is a mark of his strength of character. And he retained his faith in God to the very moment of his death. As one writer has said, God placed Samson among the giants of faith, listing him by name no less, and with God there are no mistakes. And then if you think about it, almost all of the descriptions mentioned towards the end of Hebrews 11 apply to Samson. Through faith, he subdued a kingdom. Through faith, he stopped the mouth of a lion. Through his faith, he escaped the edge of the sword. Through faith, out of weakness, he was made strong. His faith waxed valiant in fight. His faith meant that he turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Because of his faith, he was tortured, not accepting deliverance. His faith allowed him to endure trials of cruel mocking and bonds and imprisonment. Those are the things mentioned at the end of this chapter, and they all apply to Samson. And Samson is a striking type of Christ, a child of promise, born for a specific purpose, reached out to the Gentiles for a bride, destroyed the attacking lion in God's vineyard, struck down the enemies of God's people. He was betrayed by his friends, and he voluntarily and willingly sacrificed his life to further God's purpose. When you think about Samson, it's not so surprising that he's in Hebrews chapter 11. What about Noah? Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So Noah did what he did in reverence. That's the New American Standard Bible. He was moved with godly fear, the New King James, or moved with fear, the Authorized Version. This was the attribute which made him act as he did. It was a combination of respect and awe and being afraid. The fear was there because when God said he would destroy the whole earth, Noah believed him. He wasn't like all the others who thought it was a mad Project Fear story that would never actually happen. Noah recognized and accepted the power and the intent of God, and he was afraid for himself and his family. One commentary said, apprehension of coming danger, which sprang from a sense of God's holiness and man's sinfulness. God asked Noah to recognize that life in the short and medium term was going to be dreadful. Everything he knew was going. The very world he was familiar with would become unrecognizable, and it would never return to what it was. And God told him that this coming trauma would engulf him and his family as well. And his only hope was to believe in God's way of escape. There was nothing whatever he could do to save himself without God's help. And so it was that in reverence and moved with godly fear, he prepared an ark for the salvation of his household. And we shouldn't miss the fact that in Hebrews chapter 12, the writer exhorts us to have exactly the same attitude. He says, let us serve God with reverence and godly fear. The same two qualities that characterized Noah. Noah was 428 years old when he was warned by God about the flood. And he was 502 years old when the first of his children was born. And that is interesting because it was exceptionally late in life to have the first child. I just want to read out to you the previous generations and the ages at which they had their first child. Adam was 130. Seth was 105. Enos was 90. Canaan was 70. Mahalalel was 65. Jared was 162. Enoch was 65. Methuselah was 187. And Lamech was 182. So they were all lower than 187 or lower. And then Noah, 502. And I think that very fact tells us two things about Noah. First, it tells us that his faith in God was such that he saw no difficulty at all in starting a family after he had been warned about the impending flood, even though that flood would come well within the lifespan of those children. And secondly, I think it implies that Noah probably married late in life. And perhaps that was because he was struggling to find a woman who shared his faith in God. And it took him a long while to find her. And yet we know with the benefit of hindsight that he chose well, because he married literally the only woman of her generation whom God thought worthy of being saved. And this is about all we know about Noah and his way of life in the period before the flood warning. But we know that in general terms, he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. That he was described as a just man and perfect in his generations. That he walked with God, and that he found grace. If you find something, you've probably been looking specifically for it. So Noah, flying in the face of all his contemporaries, was searching for God's grace or God's acceptance. He was a just man. It means righteous, correct, or lawful in character and conduct. He was perfect. It doesn't mean he was faultless, but it means he was morally upright, complete, whole, blameless. He was a sinner, but he was blameless, forgiven because of his godly attitude. And it says he walked with God. And the prophet Amos says very clearly, can two walk together unless they be agreed? Hebrews 11:7 says Noah was moved. We're told that he prepared for what was coming and that he became an heir of righteousness. And in our days, the world again is morally decayed, and it's morally decayed to the point where the only answer again is that most of its people will have to be destroyed. and a new order set up. And I think that, like Noah, we also should be moved with fear about the coming catastrophe. We should stand in awe about what God is going to bring upon our world very soon. And I think, like Noah, we should be a bit afraid, because that fear will motivate us to prepare for the saving of our household. That feeling of fear and apprehension about what is coming should lead us to urgent preparations for the saving of our house. If we don't have that certain amount of fear, we might not do that. And by our example, we should be encouraging all in our spiritual household to get ready for what is coming. Our way of life, like Noah, should expose the godlessness of the world around us. As like the heirs we are, we wait for our perfect inheritance beyond the reach of change and decay, as Peter puts it in his first epistle. Jacob, Hebrews 11:21. By faith Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. That's all Hebrews 11 records about Jacob, this man of huge faith. And it's true that for many of the people referred to in this chapter, the writer mentions just one event out of their whole life. For Jacob, it is this one event right at the end of his life as he was dying, the time when he blessed the two sons of Joseph. At the time, Jacob was 147 years old. When he'd spoken to Pharaoh on his arrival in Egypt 17 years earlier, he had said, "Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." The words suggest that he thought he was nearing the end of his life then. His age then of 130 years was indeed fairly short when compared to his immediate ancestors. Terah was 205, Abraham 175, Isaac 180. And yet the comparative shortness of Jacob's life and the fact that it had been so difficult didn't really trouble him. He described his own life as the days of the years of my pilgrimage. And for Jacob, as for Isaac and Abraham, his life had only been a journey. He'd been satisfied to live as a pilgrim, a wanderer, a temporary sojourner, because he too sought something better. He sought life, length of life, and perfect quality of life only in the future age. Like his grandfather Abraham, he looked for a city which hath foundations, and he desired, as Hebrews 11 says, a better country. And yet Jacob's pilgrimage was to extend for another 17 years, until at the age of 147, and we read that the time drew nigh that Israel must die. And when Jacob realized this was about to happen, he had one priority. His priority was to return, even in death, to the land God had promised him. That was where he wanted to be while he waited for his resurrection. He wanted to be actually lying in the earth of his eternal inheritance. And so he made Joseph promise to bury him in that land. It was a very solemn moment, and Jacob instructed Joseph to put thy hand under my thigh. This symbolizes a very solemn agreement. The hand in that position was close to the place of Jacob's circumcision, which was the very symbol of the covenant between himself and God. Genesis 46 indicate that the thigh or loins was indicative of a man's posterity, and Jacob was looking to the future generations of his family through whom the covenant would be continued. And that these things were exercising Jacob's mind is evident from the Genesis record. Because when on his deathbed he was visited by Joseph and his two sons, he recounts some of the key events in his life. He remembers how God had worked in his life, how he trusted God would continue to work through the lives of his descendants. He wanted to bless Joseph's sons, expressing the wish that they would grow into a multitude. But like his mother Rebekah, Jacob knew that God did not respect the human tradition of primogeniture, the automatic right of the eldest son to succeed. He knew that he himself had been chosen by God in preference to his older brother Esau. And in the blessing of his two grandchildren, the children of Joseph, he bestowed the greater blessing on the younger son Ephraim, and he did that despite Joseph's initial protestations. Jacob knew that in doing this he was doing God's will. It says he acted wittingly, that's with knowledge, with understanding, with wisdom, without doubt being guided by God. So on reflection, it's no wonder that the writer to the Hebrews chose this one event in Jacob's life to put on record as an example of this man's immense faith. A man who was full of trust and hope right at the end of a troubled life. A man on his deathbed, but still looking forward to his eternal inheritance in the promised land, and to the perpetuation of the seed which God had promised him. I want to go on now to Rahab. Hebrews 11:31 says, Rahab perished not with them that believed not. The key words here, I think, are them that believed not. Rahab perished not with them that believed not. Who were these people who believed not? Jericho, of course, was the first fruits of Israel's conquest of the promised land on the west of Jordan. And so it was devoted to God who decreed that the city should be completely destroyed apart from Rahab and all that are with her in the house. And then Joshua chapter 6 goes on to say that those in the house with Rahab were her father, her mother, her brethren, and all that she had, together with her kindred. So in the house with Rahab were her immediate family, her parents and her brothers. They were saved, and others were too. People who were probably not her relatives, but who nevertheless shared her deliverance. And they are the ones referred to in Joshua 6 as her kindred. They were there in her house with her immediate family, but they weren't members of her family. And in many places in Scripture, this word translated kindred, her kindred, is rendered as families. And so it seems likely to me that Rahab's house in Jericho became a sanctuary not only for her own family, but also for other families. families who had come to share her faith in the God of Israel. Those who, like her, were aware that their city was to be divinely destroyed and who were looking, like her, for the salvation that the God of Israel alone could provide. I think the writer to the Hebrews is indicating that Rahab had not kept quiet about the faith which she had gained from her contact with the Jewish spies. Rahab, he says, perished not with them that believed not, or as the marginal rendering indicates, with them that were disobedient. Some in Jericho, though they had been given an opportunity to believe, had rejected it. They believed not, and therefore they perished, said Hebrews 11. And we can picture what might have happened here. As the Israelites approached Jericho and circled the city, Rahab would have explained to her family and to others about her what was happening, what was going to happen, and why. She would explain that salvation had been promised to her because of her faith, and that their own survival could be assured if they also believed, and if they also then remained within the sanctuary of her house. Some believed her message and sought the safety of her home, while others, the unbelievers, the disobedient, did not believe her, and therefore would have perished in the city's destruction. And it was only Rahab, her immediate family, and those others who comprised her kindred, those who believed and acted as she did, who survived. And obviously there are clear types for us here. Joshua, a type of Jesus, coming as he did with a contingent of God's immortal army of angels, as described in Joshua 5. Coming to challenge the apparently invincible might of Jericho, just as Jesus will come to destroy the apparently invincible cities of our world, impregnable though they think they are. It's probable that Rahab and the faithful ones with her, her family and her kindred, were not removed from Jericho before the attack on the city began. It looks as though the walls collapsed first, then the faithful were removed, and then the city was destroyed by fire. And this is probably a pointer to the fact that we will witness the first dramatic and serious stages of God's judgments on the world of our day before we are taken away to safety. But this record, recalled by Hebrews chapter 11, demonstrates God's ability to protect his servants. Rahab's house was on the wall of Jericho, and the walls of the city fell down flat. But the segment of the wall where she lived was obviously divinely allowed to stay safe. And God's protection of his servants will apply in the future as well. But there is a marked lesson for us here, brethren and sisters. If any of those people with Rahab had strayed from her house, if they'd mingled and fraternized with the unbelievers of their day, their own salvation would have been forfeited. They would have been caught up in the total destruction which engulfed their city, apart from that small area of it which was specifically watched over and protected by the angels. So in closing, we've looked at just four of the 16 people named in Hebrews chapter 11. People who suffered for their faith because they really believed that God exists and that he rewards those who diligently seek him. By their way of life, we're told they condemned the world and became heirs of the righteousness which is by faith. They, verse 11, judged God faithful when he made his promises to them. They, verse 13, were persuaded by God's promises and embraced them. And because of what lay ahead, they were content to be strangers and pilgrims on the earth. They, verse 38, lived in a world that was not worthy of them. Or as J.B. Phillips puts it, they lived in a world that was too evil to see their worth. And then at the end comes the challenging bit for each of us, verses 39 to 40. All these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. It's challenging because these exceptional people of faith, people who use their lives so fully in God's service, are being kept waiting by God. They're being kept waiting by God for the reward they so fervently believed in. And they're being kept waiting so that we can replicate their faith and follow them. And when the day arrives, they will say, and God willing, we will as well, in the words of Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, this is our God for whom we have waited that he might save us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation."